Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you for supporting your local independent bookstore, and welcome. James Bond, one of the most famous spies in literary history, lives again through the talent of the fabulous thriller writer, Jeffrey Deaver. Although most noted for his Lincoln Rhyme series, Mr. Deaver has taken on the immense literary task of continuing the Bond legacy with his first new James Bond book, Carte Blanche, a thriller worthy of Ian Fleming's original novels. Please welcome Jeffrey Deaver.
Thank you, Cameron, and all my friends here at this wonderful bookstore. I enjoy creating my heroes, and you may know Lincoln Rhyme and Catherine Dance, and of course James Bond is a wonderful hero. But truth be told, we love our villains more than anything else. And nobody created better villains than Ian Fleming. And I think of Goldfinger. We all know, if not the book, at least the movie, the wonderful Sean Connery film. And at one point in the book, at least, I don't recall if it's in the movie, Goldfinger says to James Bond, upon meeting him rather unexpectedly under rather curious circumstances, "Mr. Bond, there's a saying in Chicago that goes like this. Meeting once unexpectedly is happenstance. Meeting twice unexpectedly is coincidence. Meeting three times unexpectedly is enemy action." Well, that, in paraphrase, perfectly describes my coming to write Carte Blanche, the new James Bond novel. And I'm going to explain what I mean by that. Happenstance, my first connection with James Bond. I was 8 years old, and I read my first James Bond novel. A bit young, wouldn't you think? Well, in fact, in the 1950s, I was growing up, the books, even thrillers, were rather euphemistically written. The romantic liaisons were all off camera. The violence was very subdued. And basically, they were just good action novels. And I fell in love with this action hero, who was sort of like out of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight or Lord of the Rings. And he just moved forward after the bad guy, the knight chasing down the dragon. And then, of course, I'd come to the horrifying part, the disgusting part, where my hero kissed a girl? Oh, the horror, the shame of it all. Now, a few years later, I went back and reread those scenes. And reread them, of course. But I did find that there was something really captivating about this man's ability to tell a very straightforward story about good versus evil. Well, that was my first connection with Bond, and that is what I call happenstance. Now, remember Goldfinger's comment? Coincidence, the second connection with Bond. About 6 years ago, my book Garden of Beasts won the Steel Dagger Award for the Crime Writers Association in England that was sponsored by the Ian Fleming Estate. They gave the award for the best spy novel of the year. I've only written one spy novel, and it was a historical novel set in Berlin in 1936, Garden of Beasts. But they felt it was the best spy novel that they had seen that year and gave me the award. Well, in accepting that, I commented very much as I had a few moments ago that Ian Fleming was a big influence in my life. I loved the way he put together a story. He was somebody I aspired to be because I was a nerd when I was growing up. I had no talent for sports. You know how it works in school, of course, when there are two teams, you're going to play softball at recess or basketball, and there are the captains who are the cool guys, and then they have to pick the rest of the class members to be on their team. They get to pick one, then the other captain picks one. I'm sure that both captains for whatever team I was trying out for would work out some kind of Bobby Fischer end game so that they were sure they wouldn't get me on the team. But suffice it to say, that was okay with me because I loved books and I loved writing. And Ian Fleming influenced my writing so much so that I began writing when I was 11 years old. I wrote my first, I call it a novel, actually it was really a short story, but it had a couple chapters in it. It had cover art, which I did myself. And guess what? It featured a British secret agent who snuck into Russia to steal a secret airplane. And his name was not Fred Bond, but it could very well have been. Well, apparently the estate took those words to heart. And when I say estate, I should preface that by saying, for those of you who don't know, Ian Fleming passed away at a very young age in the mid-1960s. But because Bond had become such an icon, such a hero at that point, the estate decided to continue not only the movies, but enlisting the aid of other authors to continue the series. I am the fifth in the group. And so 18 months ago, they called me up and said, would I be interested in writing the next James Bond novel? I debated 5 seconds and said, I'm your man. Let's sign this up. Well, it wasn't quite as easy as that for several reasons. I have a great responsibility to you folks. First of all, I write a very specific kind of book, a very fast-paced thriller. It has lots of deadlines in it, every few chapters. It has a big surprise ending. And then after that, there's a surprise ending. And following that, there's something else. Wait, a surprise ending. Yes, that's right. Because I love my, guess what, surprise endings. And Ian Fleming did not write that way. I also feel a responsibility to give you the greatest emotional impact I possibly can. And that involves generally writing a book set in the present day. Although, ironically, Garden of Beasts was an historical novel, I still think the greatest emotional impact is achieved by a present-day book with real dangers and real touchstones of popular culture that we know about and we can feel. And so I said to the estate, well, you know, I would love to do this. However, I want Bond to be updated. I want him to be a young 30-ish secret agent working for the British Security Organization. But I want the book set in the present day. And they said, Jeff, how about that? We want Bond to be a young 30-ish secret agent working for the British government set in the present day. So we shook hands and we went to work. And I did just that. I created, in carte blanche, a Jeffrey Deaver novel, as I described it. But now, all of a sudden, there was a new challenge. And the new challenge was to make not only you guys, those of you who know my writing, I'm not saying everybody here does, but those of you who have been fans and readers for a long time, I'm going to give you the kind of book I just described, the fast-paced, twisty-turny thing. It takes place over only a few days. But I've got a whole new group of people to make sure they're happy too. And I had to work a little harder than normal because, as I say, the Ian Fleming novels are a bit different. They're very character driven. They're brilliant stories. Ian Fleming was a journalist. He was a very smart man, and he brought a lot of social observation and geopolitical insight into his books. But that's not really what I do. I write this roller coaster of a ride. And so I said, the only way to do that is to make Bond real for the present day. I have to make a character that they are going to recognize from the old days and yet be completely updated so that they like him. We have to like our hero. So I did a few things. I did some adjustments. For instance, Bond still drives a fast car. There are the Bond ladies or Bond women. I don't say Bond girls. That's a thing of the past. Bond does not smoke anymore. Not because this kind of a smoking has a bad image nowadays, but because it's not a smart thing for a spy to do. Because fewer people smoke now. And when one does smoke, it draws attention to you. Not only that, but smoking leaves a lot of evidence. You've all seen Monk or CSI, right? You know, who's the bad guy? The bad guy smokes. Not because he's evil. It's because he leaves a lot of evidence. DNA on the cigarette butts, tobacco can be typed, and so forth. So Bond doesn't smoke anymore. In the original books, Bond was an orphan. His parents had died when he was 11 years old. And Fleming never went further than that. To me, that's a rather primal event that I thought informed who James Bond was. But Ian Fleming, for whatever reason, didn't really explore that. And I thought, I want to look at that. I want to look at who his parents were and how those deaths affected him. And did that, in fact, maybe make him become a spy? I don't necessarily answer those questions, but I like to ask them, and I want you to think about them. So that's the Bond I created. And then I put this poor guy in a Deaver book, so he never gets a moment's rest. unlike my other books where, I have certainly romantic situations, we have to have Bond have a love interest, and he does in this book, a wonderful woman who works for a nonprofit concerned about hunger in Africa, hunger and AIDS in Africa, which is a cause that is very realistic. And but nonetheless, Bond basically is on a roller coaster ride from page one to the very end of the book. Now, I could continue to talk about Carte Blanche. I know it rather well. I wrote it. But if I did that, it's kind of counterproductive because you might think, like most trailers, aren't we all irritated by trailers and movies? Can't we figure out the complete movie in the 7 seconds of really loud music? And they all seem to have like a Russian men's chorus in the background. Think about it. Next time you see one, I'm going to spoil every trailer for you. The Russian men's chorus is singing that music, and there's all those, those cuts that they do there. Anyway, I'm not going to spoil the book for you. I want you to buy it. I'm sorry. It's all self-interest up here. But not to worry. The entertainment, such as it is not completed yet, because I'm going to talk about the general process of writing not only Carte Blanche, but all of my books. And I'm not going to spend too much time because I want to get to your questions, and I want to make sure we sign up all the books if you'd like me to do that. But I'm going to go through the chronological, I'd call them bullet points, of how I approach writing one of my thrillers. I'm not saying this is right for you. If you're an author, you may do it entirely differently. I know we have some authors here tonight. And whatever works for you is what's important. This works for me, and I'm comfortable doing it. I also feel it's right. Oh, I don't mean to put it quite that way. It's right for me and for the type of book I write, which is a very specific plot-driven thriller. And we're going to go through these points in chronological order right now. And number one is, it's a business. It's not art. Frankly, I don't think most art is art. And if you talk to somebody like Rembrandt or William Shakespeare, they got paid on commission to entertain or to do basically photoshopped pictures of the people they were painting. It was a job. It's a business. Writing novels, certainly commercial fiction, is a business, which means I'm under a contractual obligation to provide a book once a year, if not twice a year, to my publisher. Simple as that. I'm Procter & Gamble. They make toothpaste. I make books. No difference whatsoever. We satisfy different needs, but it's still the same theory. Point one. Point two, if it's a business, we need a business plan, right? Of course, many of you are involved in business, and every company you're engaged in has a business plan. Well, I have a business plan, and I stole it from, guess who? Procter & Gamble. And I call it the mint-flavored toothpaste business plan, as opposed to the liver-flavored toothpaste business plan. Now imagine this. A fellow goes to work at Procter & Gamble, and he says, boss, I got a great idea for a product, liver-flavored toothpaste. And his boss says, why? He says, because nobody's ever thought of it before, and it's neat, and it will get us publicity. And his boss says, and guess what? It's getting you fired. Why? Because people don't want liver-flavored toothpaste. Why should a book be any different than that? Our responsibility is to give you folks, in return for your, certainly, realistically, because it's a business, your money, but more important, your time, the time you invest in a book. We need to give you what you want, something that's pleasurable and enjoyable and entertaining. Or if you're Annie Proulx or Jonathan Franzen, who write loftier books and do a wonderful job at it, give you some intellectual stimulation and make you question society and relationships. But I entertain, so I want to give you a book that entertains. That's mint-flavored toothpaste. I keep that in the back of my mind every time I sit down to write a book. This is not about me coming up with a clever idea. This is about me giving you something that you are going to get a consistently good product. It may have mint flakes in it. It may have little tiny globules of mint. It may not have globules at all. It might just be blue or green and taste like mint. Or it could be cinnamon. Who knows? But it's going to be something that you're going to want. So there's our business plan. We want to create mint-flavored toothpaste, right? Now we need a specific product to make. That is, I need an idea for my book. I was on tour in England. A panel of four or five of us were up on the podium, and the question was presented to all of us, where do you get your ideas? Now, the woman at the end was a writer of cozies, and I'm sure you're probably familiar with cozies. Agatha Christie wrote cozies. They're a little softer kind of book. I used to say that Janet Ivanovich wrote cozies, and you're familiar with Janet's books, I'm sure, wonderful stories. I said that until in one of the books, Grandma Mazur blew somebody away with her .357 Magnum. That kind of took it out of the cozy realm. But suffice it to say that this woman wrote a British drawing room cozies. And the question went to her first, where do you get your ideas? And she said, well, I sit down in my parlor with a cup of tea, and I wait for my muse, whose name is Frederica or Philomena, to tap me on the head, and poof, there's an idea. And I started to laugh, but I was the only American there. And it turned out that everybody was staring at her with rapt attention, that there's, oh, go, Philomena, go, Frederica. They loved muses there. I thought she was kidding, but no, she was dead serious. Well, then the question goes to me, and I have to be honest about it. Where do I get my ideas? I said, well, I sit down in my living room, too, with a beverage. It isn't tea. And I simply try to think of a way to scare your socks off. You get in a taxi cab in a strange town, and you give the driver directions, and it goes a place that's a little different from where you think it ought to go. And then you tell him to stop, and he doesn't. And when finally there's a red light and he stops, you reach for the door to jump out, but there are no latches on the door. The beginning of The Bone Collector. Or you may have, for instance, a fellow sitting in a data mining company, sucking all your information out of your credit card receipts and your personal life and your bank accounts, and he draws all your money out, and he sends fake emails to people in your name that embarrasses you. Or he, of course, as recently happened, hacked into a Twitter account in New York. Wink, wink, nod, nod. You know why that would never happen to me? Because I don't have a physique that would even for a minute make me think to tweet anything other than me wearing a suit like this. So anyway, that was the beginning of The Broken Window. And ideas that scare people. And I won't give away what the scary part of Carte Blanche is. That you'll have to find for yourself. But there's our, we have our idea, whatever it might be. We've got rule one, it's a business. Two, I have my business plan. Three, I've got my scary idea. Well, okay, now I've got a year to write the book. Remember the contract? Because it's a business. So I sit down and I start to write, right? Sit down, write the book, write. Oh, some of you have been here before. I see, no, you're being a little skeptical of this. And I'll explain to you why. I'll give you an illustration of why I don't sit down and write the book, even with a brilliant idea. Let's say that I decided I didn't want to write books anymore. What I wanted to do, thank you for those of you who said, oh, I heard a few of you out there. I don't want to write books anymore. What I want to do is build airplanes. And so I call up Fred's airplane company, and I say, Fred, I want to write books. So I'm sorry, I'm tired of writing books. I want to make airplanes now. So deliver me a bunch of airplane stuff. What? Well, I don't know. Bring me wings. bring me some engines, bring me wheels, bring me, those video games that the pilots play with, and just up in the cockpit, and deliver it all to me. And he does, and there's a big pile of airplane stuff and nuts and bolts in my front yard. And I get my wrench and my torch, and I put on the helmet and the goggles, and I go out and I start to put an airplane together. I put the wings on top at first. I don't like that. I'm going to put them on the bottom. And the tail. Well, they call it a tail, but does it have to be in the tail? Let's put it in the front and see how that works. I'll call it the front, not the tail. Well, I'm not going to go over this in great depth, but you get the idea. No, I'm not going to get on an airplane that was built that way. Why should I buy a book that was built according to a hit and miss program? I get on airplanes that have been made according to engineering diagrams and specifications. I'm going to buy a book that is done exactly the same way. I'm speaking again of one of my type of books, not a character-driven book, not literature. I'm talking about a very complex, plot-driven novel in a very compressed time frame. I do an outline. My outlines are, they can be any number of pages. Garden of Beasts was 220 pages long, the outline alone. Carte Blanche was a little shorter book, was 140 pages. And that outline has every element of the plots, plural, in it. I know where every character is introduced. I know when they leave the book, either vertically or horizontally, as some of my characters do. I have all the clues that make those surprise endings work seeded very carefully through the book, but also disguised, so that when you come to the first surprise ending, you say, oh, I should have seen that coming. Because on page 42 or in chapter 3 somewhere, Jeff had presented the reason why this was going to happen, but he covered it up pretty well. Anyway, you have to have all that organized, and then at the same time you do the research and kind of cross-reference the research, so that when I come to scene 84 in the outline, I can just look at scene 84 and then refer to the material for the research and know what fits in there. So yes, it's methodical. Yes, it's formulaic. But I'm sorry, folks, surgery is formulaic and it works. Theater is formulaic and it works. Plays, the three-act movies, the three-act structure, it works. There's a reason it works. Because we take into account everyone's interest and how they approach a creative product. And I'm a firm believer in outlines. Well, now the outline's done, and yes, now we write the book. And because we know where the book is going to go, we can write it very, very quickly. Now, with the outline, I may wake up one morning, and theoretically, chronologically, the next scene to write is a vicious murder. But I'm in a good mood. The birds are singing, the sun's shining. I don't want to kill somebody that day. You know, we all feel like that occasionally, don't we? Please say yes. I mean, maybe some of you do want to kill somebody every day. I don't know. That's up to you. But I personally reserve days for writing those scenes for when the plumber says he's going to show up at 8:30 in the morning and doesn't bother to arrive until 5. And then guess what the name of the victim is? Never mess with an author. Anyway, I write the book. Out it comes. I can write the book very quickly in any order because I know the order from the outline. I can write the ending first, the beginning last if I want. And so the book is now done. Now's where I mail it off to my publisher, and then in a day or two comes the stretch limo with the bikini-clad girls with the bags of gold. Well, that's how we get paid. You know, the authors do that. Right, that's when. No, you know that you've been there before. No, we don't, because the first draft of all books is two things: it's too long, and it's really bad, because it's easier to write longer than it is to write concisely, and it's easier to write badly than it is to write well. So we rewrite. Ernest Hemingway said there are no great writers. There are only great rewriters. And I believe that. I rewrite 40 or 50 times before another human being sees the book. And then I hire two outside copy editors to read it and pick it apart and say, oh, it's rush hour? Let me get this straight. And you're downtown Denver and you're driving to Highlands Ranch at 5 o'clock, and James Bond is in his Bentley. I don't care if he's in his Bentley. He's still not going to be there in 10 minutes, Jeff. Change this. A helicopter would have to be involved. And when then I send it to the publisher and we go through the editing process again. But I'm going to show you the importance of rewriting and editing. And we're going to do this right now. And this is a, I guess I'd call it a fictional fiction. The passage I'm about to read was not from one of my real fictional books, but it's something I wrote for illustrative purposes here. And it involves a police officer named Carlson. It occurs at the end of our book, whatever that might be, who has tracked down an assassin who's just about to kill the victim. And I'll read this now. Breathing hard, gasping, Carlson climbed the stairs to the water tower where the assassin was aiming at his victim 100 feet below. In pained agony, bleeding from the flesh wound in the side he'd sustained a half hour before, he fought against the urge for rest, for comfort, for solace. Now he reached into his jacket, and exhausted and sweating fiercely, his Glock 23 was in his hand, loaded with 13 rounds of deadly 40 caliber ammunition. He glanced at his watch. There was no time left. It was fourth down, and he had to come out swinging. Now, summoning his final reserves of strength, like spun sugar, he kicked in the door and leapt inside. The wide-eyed assassin spun around. "You found me," the man cried. "How?" "I've been on your trail since Sunday," Carlson explained. "I knew that the police sergeant working with us had to be a plant paid off by you. Otherwise, you would have killed him when you had the chance." Like lightning, the killer lifted the Bushmaster M4 223 caliber semi-auto assault rifle toward Carlson's chest. But the cop had trained for moments like this for years, and he knew that to disable an adversary under these circumstances, you instantly fired a group of three bullets into the frontal lobe of his brain to prevent any reactive gunfire whatsoever. This is what he now did. The man muttered an inaudible prayer and spiraled to the floor. Okay, now we take out our pen. And red, blue, or green, whatever we want, and we edit. Breathing hard and gasping. Oh, that's redundant. We don't need both of those. Take one out. Carlson climbed the stairs to the water tower. We need that information. In pained agony, probably one is enough. Bleeding from the flesh wound in his side. What other kind of wound is there? I've been thinking about this. You could have a wound, I suppose, in your teeth or your fingernail. But other than that, don't they have to be in the flesh somewhere? But more important, it's a cliche. Let's see. Okay, so now Carlson, he's fought against the urge for rest and for comfort and for solace. Carlson, you're a cop. Can you get away with just one of those? Don't be a mama's boy, okay? And I'm going to read this sentence again, and then I'm going to deconstruct it right afterwards. Reached into his jacket, and exhausted and sweating fiercely, his Glock 23 was in his hand, loaded with 13 rounds of deadly 40 caliber ammunition. What I just said was, his Glock, it's an automatic pistol, was exhausted and sweating fiercely. I said that his hand was loaded with 13 rounds of ammunition, and under the circumstances, admittedly, yes, there is blank ammunition, but do we really have to say deadly 40 caliber ammunition? I think we can assume that a police officer is going to have pretty deadly ammunition in his gun. Glanced at his watch, no time left. Fourth down, and he had to come out swinging. Mixed metaphor alert, and what's worse, even more horrifying than that, mixed cliched metaphor alert. The wide-eyed assassin spun around. "You found me how? I've been on your trail since Sunday. Blah, 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 blah." Carlson, he's an assassin. He's got a gun. Don't talk. Shoot. Like lightning, the killer lifted his Bushmaster M4 223 assault rifle, et cetera, et cetera. Outdoor channel stuff. He's an assassin with a gun. Don't talk. Shoot. He trained for moments like this for years. He fired a group of three bullets. Don't reflect. Shoot. Finally, thank goodness, Carlson shoots him. Whoa. He mutters an inaudible prayer and spirals to the floor. Oh, wait, if it's an inaudible prayer, how does Carlson know that it's a prayer? Okay, do these make the book on whole liver-flavored toothpaste? They come pretty close. We can't do that. We can't interrupt somebody's enjoyment of the book by having them say, Carlson, just shut up and shoot. It makes you feel bad. That's not what this is about. So anyway, we rewrite. That's our job, right? We have to rewrite. And so after great reflection and a great deal of sweat and agony, we have this rather lengthy new edition. And this is how it finally appears in the printed version sold here at the tattered cover. Gasping, Carlson climbed to the water tower, kicked in the door, and shot the assassin in the head. Does it get the job done? It does get the job done. Well, that's pretty much it. Then the book goes in and the bikini-clad girls come with the bags of gold. And I am not quite, however, ready to jump into the limo yet and head off for my my vacation with the girls. Why? Rule number one, it's a business. Very good. Which means I have to market the book as well. But I want to do that. I want to go out. I want to meet you, largely because I enjoy it. I sit in a dark room for way too long, and I'm a social kind of person, and I enjoy meeting you folks and saying hi. But more important, I want to get your feedback. I want you to tell me that this was liver-flavored toothpaste, or this was, you know, maybe baking soda toothpaste, that Tom's stuff, if he still makes that, which is good for you, but you know, I don't really care for it that much. It's not liver or chicken, but it isn't exactly what I want. And that's helpful to me. I really do enjoy that. I was on book tour in California a few years ago, and a woman came up, woman in her late 80s or early 90s, and she said, Mr. Deaver, we are in a retirement community right next to the bookstore, and we read all your books. We love them. But I wanted to ask you a question at the signing, not in front of everybody else. For the record, that makes us really nervous. But that's okay. She's a fan. She can do no wrong. Fans are gods. You're what this is all about. So I said, please, ask away. And she said, well, we've read all your books in our book club. And, you know, I want to talk to you about the violence in your books. So I took a deep breath and I said, oh, you know, that's fine. Ask anything you want. She said, well, I kind of hate to say this, but we think you're going soft on us. The bone collector, you scalded that victim to death, and you had rats crawling all over somebody. This last book, you stabbed a couple people. We want you to get back to your roots. Well, did that mean I was then going to write all my books as according to the Saw franchise, which I found absurd and pointless waste of celluloid if they even used film to make those things? Gore is not suspense. Gore is cheap and easy. Suspense, a la Alfred Hitchcock, is hard to construct, but it's emotionally much more uplifting and engaging and fun, frankly. And these books should be fun. They should not be repulsive and shocking. But it did tell me that I didn't need to pull away from the scene quite so quickly. And if you read Carte Blanche, you'll find a couple of scenes in there that are certainly not over the top. They would not appear in some bad, gruesome films, but they're a bit edgier, and I think they're appropriate, which is, of course, the key. Just a word about what's coming up next, a new Catherine Dance next year, and a new Lincoln Rhyme the year after that. The Carte Blanche was a one-book contract. I can't say that I will never write another one. I enjoyed the process very much. The Ian Fleming Estate was great to work with, and should, thanks to you guys, Carte Blanche become the next James Bond in the Deadly Hallows, you know, that kind of runaway bestseller, which I'm sure you will contribute to. I could see that happening. All right. Well, thank you all so much. I'm going to turn the program back to our wonderful host here.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.